Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. As an abstract principle, the rule of law has been revered for thousands of years. For most of that time, law was made by kings, emperors, or the heads of churches, and its enforcement meant carrying out their will. Under democracy, law's purpose is to reflect the public interest, the public conscience, as determined by true representatives of the people. Most Americans believe the rule of law is essential to justice, but opinion polls show that the profession essential to the application of law, that of lawyer, is not held in high esteem. Knowing that, why would a smart young woman want to become one? Kim Clement made that choice. Kim, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
Both of my parents were lawyers, and I grew up in Berkeley, California.
Any connection between their profession and your choice of profession?
Absolutely.
Why?
I'm actually a fifth-generation attorney. My great-great-grandfather, after the Civil War, came to California and went to law school, came to California, and was one of the first mayors of Oakland. My great-grandfather was a justice on the state Supreme Court of California. My grandfather was the administrator for the courts of the United States and worked before that in the Department of Justice, powerfully working on civil rights. Both my parents are lawyers. It was just meant to be.
And how young were you when you realized it was meant to be?
Fifth grade.
10 years, 11 years old.
Right.
Where'd you go to law school?
I went to the University of Southern California and George Washington.
First, you observed your parents as lawyers. How did the profession strike you from that perspective?
Fun.
Fun. Now, that's not a word that comes immediately to mind. Why fun?
Both my parents loved practicing law, and they brought home to me what they were doing. I used to help my dad mark exhibits for his trials. Mother did family law, and she would talk about the trials and tribulations of relationships and how she helped.
And when you went to law school, let's say when you graduated, did you have any sort of different perspective than you got from your parents?
I didn't realize how I was going to have to do jobs I didn't like at first.
Like?
The first job I had was right out of law school before I passed the bar, compiling state and federal statutes affecting consumer credit financing. It couldn't have been more boring.
Okay, so you had to do some things you didn't like. And how about the study of law itself? Did anything in that pursuit surprise you, positively or negatively?
No, it was, I knew what the Socratic method was, which is the professors pose questions and you've read the cases, so you are called upon to answer what the rules are that have been set out in the cases. I have to say I much more enjoyed college, which was more of an academic pursuit, I thought. Law school was more rote.
And in college you studied?
I was an American history major, but I studied whatever I wanted. I became almost fluent in French and took biology.
When did you graduate law school?
76.
We interviewed Sandra Day O'Connor a few years ago, and she graduated Stanford in 1952, 24 years earlier. Number two in her class, behind William Rehnquist. She couldn't get a job interview because she was a woman. Were you aware of that history, A, and B, did you experience anything like it?
Her story is legion. It was much different by the time I was there. I don't think I had to do poor jobs jobs I didn't enjoy because I was a woman. They're just hard to get good litigation jobs.
Did her experience, which you've indicated you were familiar with, did it affect your attitude at all toward the practice of law or the profession, the history of discrimination against women?
Well, interestingly, it didn't make me want to be in that area. It just made me want to push forward and succeed in what I wanted to do.
Meaning because you were a woman, you wanted to prove something?
Sort of.
I've looked at your bio, and in summary form, for 30 of the last 35 years, you've practiced law, and by any lawyer's standard, had a distinguished career. Would you give us just a summary of the different positions and types of law you've practiced over that time, chronologically?
Well, as I described, when I started, I was doing jobs I didn't enjoy as much, including working for the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts, advising public defenders on a law that applied to them. Then I was a clerk on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, again, cloistered in an office giving judges summaries of cases. But the best job I got was being an assistant U.S. attorney for the Northern District of California, where I did both criminal and civil work. I was young. My very first trial, I lost $1 million, and I still got a call from the head of the torts branch in the Department of Justice congratulating me on the result, because it was a stipulated liability case.
Now, I don't know what stipulated liability is.
That means we said, okay, this person got Guillain-Barré syndrome from a swine flu shot, but how much is that worth?
So you were congratulated on the relatively low award.
Yes. But okay. I was trying big cases that if I had been in a private firm, I would not have been able to do.
So you worked for the U.S. attorney for how long?
5 years.
How many trials?
31.
Interesting to me you remember the number so clearly, suggesting that it was an important experience to you?
It was very important. I wanted to be a judge, which is something I was not able to accomplish, but you have to keep track of your work. So I have index cards, I still have them, that have every case I ever handled, every case I tried, the results.
Trials look like one thing to an observer. Most of us never actually witness one. What was it like for you? What stands out?
Being a director, organizing my witnesses, the exhibits, the presentation of the case, and yet trying to make so that I was the one who was really the centerpiece. I was in control, hopefully in control of the courtroom, but trying to push it over so that it was the witnesses and the documents that were speaking my case.
Now that describes for me a strategic approach to managing a complex interactive process. How was it for you emotionally, personally? Satisfying and not? Why?
Extremely satisfying because I was able to have such freedom to organize it the way I wanted, present it the way I felt was appropriate. There wasn't really supervision. So it was very satisfying because I was able to really pull together, again, complicated ideas and convey them to the trier of fact, be it a jury or a judge.
Why was that personally satisfying?
I felt that was my calling, and I wanted to win for the government.
We're later going to discuss your private practice where you weren't representing the government. In this case, the government was your client and you wanted to win for your client. That raises the question of justice. Law is connected with justice, and the second phrase in the preamble of the Constitution is establish justice as the purpose of the document, so the framers held it in very high regard. What's your assessment of that? In other words, you've just described a process where you wanted to win. Someone might argue that's not you wanted justice, or neither did your opponent. Each of you wanted to win. It's the adversarial system of law. What's your assessment about how well that system serves justice?
You're using justice in an abstract sense.
Okay.
I didn't do justice. I did cases to win. So the point was for me to do the best presentation of my matter as possible. And if the other side missed things, failed to put out the right witness, that's their problem.
So what I take from that is in the adversarial system of law, and I think having been to law school myself, that is in fact what we're taught, the profession is based on, in terms of litigation, on winning for your client.
Now, Brian, it's important to distinguish criminal versus civil.
Okay.
Most of my work was civil. In the criminal context, I was a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office and later in the District Attorney's Office in Sonoma County. In that situation, you are actually obliged to do over-fairness actions by law. And if you don't, and the other side finds out that you did not disclose some exculpatory piece of information, that could reverse your conviction. And it could cause you to get ethical sanctions.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with Kim Clement, highly experienced attorney at law, about her career. Let me see if I'm hearing this right, because it seems to me a fundamental issue. In your experience, civil litigation is about winning for the attorney, winning for your client, And it's based on the assumption, socially speaking, that an adversarial process through the trial gives the best chance of achieving, quote, end quote, a just result. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Is that fair?
Sometimes the lawyers are not equally paired.
Resulting in an unjust result. Would you say that's fair?
Yes. But it wasn't my job to fix that. I had a case, for example, in the U.S. Attorney's Office where a child was choking in the home on the Alameda Naval Air Station. The ambulance got lost getting there. And then when they finally got to this child and picked her up, they put the mother in the ambulance with her. The doors flung open. The mother fell out while it was driving. And very important issues of liability. My opponent was very poor, did not understand how to work this case up, and it settled for an extraordinarily low amount.
You were representing the government.
The government. Okay. Is this my job to add more money to the settlement offer because I know the case is worth more? No.
All right. That's the way the profession defines itself. Now let me ask you a personal question. How did you feel about it?
Fine. And as you're asking me these questions, I'm thinking, I felt fine about it because I was working in a man's world. And I wanted to show that I could be as hard-ass and tough as the rest of them. And it was clearly defined to me that getting cases for the lowest amount and winning were the parameters of success in my male world.
That, to me, is a highly interesting statement and raises another question. If the rules hadn't been defined by men as you describe it and as you experienced it, I'm going to call win at all costs, and women had had a role in defining those rules, would the ethics have been different?
I don't think so, because now we've got 50% women in, well, not 50% women in judges, but as litigators and having many more opportunities. But I don't see that this has really changed. So if women's views were going to alter it, I think that would have happened. There would have been a softening. I don't think that is what happened. And basically, it's because the system I'm describing, where, and it's not win at all costs. There are ethical constraints in the civil practice as well, but winning being the task at hand. That is basically from the Magna Carta. That is the way the system works. You cannot take a situation and feel that because your opponent is doing a poor job, the just thing to do is to tell them information that would make their case better. It just couldn't work that way. Adversarial system is adversary.
So with that reality, if in civil litigation one set of clients, let's say they have a lot of money, let's say they're corporations, for example, pitted against individuals who may or may not have a lot of money, is it fair to assume, broadly speaking, that those with money get better representation than those that don't? And end up winning more cases than, quote, end quote, justice would serve if the lawyers were equal.
You've identified a fundamental flaw, and this is true.
Next phase of your career?
Then I went to a law firm because I felt I wanted to be a judge, and I knew you had to flesh out your resume.
Okay.
I went to a well-reviewed law firm in San Francisco and did just general civil practice, bankruptcy, consumer fraud.
And did that lasted how long?
3 years.
Then what?
I got the opportunity, based on the recommendation from the U.S. attorney, to be chief trial deputy for the city and county of San Francisco. I was the first woman to hold the position, and the city attorney of San Francisco was the first woman to hold that position.
What is the job of the chief trial deputy?
I supervised 30 lawyers, and we handled all of the tort work. Now, torts are where some person is personally injured. We did police excessive force. That would be where somebody got shot by a police officer. I handled personally all of the medical malpractice. We were part of the San Francisco General Hospital. So there were, again, cases that were worth a lot of money. I was very young to get the job. I was 35 when I was appointed.
How long did you have that job?
7 years.
It takes me a minute to get my head around supervising 30 lawyers. Did you still do trial work yourself?
Yes. Part of my job was to review every complaint that came in, and then I would assign them to whichever lawyers were on my teams.
So you'd assign the ones you wanted to yourself?
Well, that's right.
How was that job compared in any respect, personal satisfaction-wise, or any other important respect to your previous legal experience?
Oh, it was a 10.
A 10?
Yes.
Why?
Well, again, I was young and I got a lot of power of the ability to pick which cases I took. I had to give the settlement authority for every case that was handled by these 30 lawyers. And again, I felt like my job was to give great representation to the city and county of San Francisco and protect the coffers. And I did that.
So when you leave, you've been practicing law 15 or 16 years. How has it been as a woman in the profession?
I had extraordinary opportunities and was able to have this profession be a great reward for me. Part of it was I didn't have children. I had a situation where I could really devote my time constantly to being a lawyer.
How was it as a woman? I'm thinking the male-female history of discrimination, day-to-day interactions with male lawyers.
Because of how much time I spent, I was respected and therefore was able to, quote, make it in a man's world. I followed their rules.
That is the second time this has come up, that phrase. You've enjoyed the work, and you've described it as making it in a man's world. Do you consider yourself to be a feminist?
Absolutely.
All right, so why does a feminist want to make it in a man's world?
That's where the money, power, esteem, and the ability to change things is. The thing is, I never tried to change anything. I was a woman being successful, but I never used that as leverage to move the woman's position forward, except in the city attorney's office, I was able to help make hiring decisions. We hired more women than had ever been in the office before.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with attorney Kim Clement about her distinguished and varied legal career. Now, you just said you didn't try to change the rules, the man's game. You played the man's game and played it very well and derived a significant degree of professional and personal satisfaction from it. But the fact that you say it now suggests that at some point that lack of pushing a woman's agenda began to bother you in some way. Fair?
That's true.
So what happened?
Well, I left the city attorney's office to pursue a private practice in Santa Rosa. I continued doing the same things, police excessive force, medical malpractice, doing a lot of tort work, until I was in a firm and then by myself. But eventually, my best cases were in San Francisco, so I would have to commute an hour each day to get to my job. The commute is what made me decide to retire early at age 49. I wasn't enjoying the work. It used to be, every morning I got up, couldn't wait to get to work. After that, when I started having to do that commute, it felt differently.
All right, so what does that have to do with reconsidering playing well in a male role?
So I retired with a plan to just pursue a happy, smooth life. And once I retired, I really entered into a stage of, I'm not a spiritual person, but I would say spiritual self-examination. And I felt that I'd been such a hard-ass person that I wondered where the kindness in me was and where it was in me to reach out to others. So I began doing a lot of volunteer work, and it all devolved into working with women, being a rape crisis counselor, working in Planned Parenthood, doing hospice work, and my hospice patients were all women, until I felt that I wanted to use my skills to do something for women instead of making my clients look better.
Now, you've just said something in 30 or so seconds that strikes me as pretty profound. You work very hard for 15 years, but you find something missing, triggered by the coincidence of commuting, but involving something much deeper. Your self-definition as a human being and a woman. Now, you mentioned you worked for Planned Parenthood and a domestic violence center?
No, I worked for Planned Parenthood doing contraception, and then I was working for a rape crisis counseling.
Rape crisis counseling, okay. What did you find out about yourself in that work? Let's take the rape crisis counseling.
I saw so many women who didn't have my opportunities, and the way their powerlessness, their lack of education, their lack of self-confidence, their lack of belief that they mattered in this world. And I realized how extraordinarily supported I was growing up.
All right. What was your reaction to their situation?
I really was surprised at the depths of pain and this cycle of powerlessness that women were experiencing. And I wanted to see if I could help.
Help in the form of what?
Well, after
rape counseling, let's say.
Well, by the rape crisis counseling, I would actually go when a woman had been raped. They can go through an examination within the first 48 hours to collect evidence. I was their advocate. I would go and sit with them while they had to, after having been raped, while they would lie on a table with, usually it was a female nurse, collecting all the evidence from their genital area,
mm-hmm.
And help and support them through that. And then I would go and sit in court with them when they had to make appearances with a criminal prosecution continued.
All right. Now back to your feelings. How did you feel at the end of a day doing that, or at the end of the time you did it?
Really good. So rewarded. Personally, I felt like I made a difference in that woman's life.
And how did that differ, if at all, from the satisfaction you had practicing law and doing very well in the practice of law?
Being a successful trial lawyer is a lot about creating your own success. And it's about you winning. This was about her winning.
And how was the hospice work for you?
Interesting in that I think a big part of my career, I had many wrongful death cases. I had a lot of cases where people died or were quadriplegics or very seriously injured.
Because of someone's negligence.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Yes.
But I really kept clear of any emotional reaction to that.
All right.
That was not my job. Now with hospice, I was opened up to a sense of compassion that I really had never brought to my view of the world before.
And how was hospice for you?
It was interesting. When I was in this law practice where I was representing the government and government entities, you had to distance yourself from the horrible things that had happened to people. I was representing the government in cases where many people had died, where they were maimed, but I never wept for these people.
Right.
This was not my job. With hospice, I got access to a sense of compassion and connection with the suffering of others.
I think it's fair to say that's a big change. Did you realize it suddenly? Did you just wake up one morning and say, I'm a changed person? And secondly, once you realized this change had taken place, what did you think?
The change was surprisingly fast. When you stop working, when you stop having that whole structure in your life, there's a lot of vacant time where all you can do is, I mean, I was by myself a lot. All you're doing is kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So that first year, I would say, is when the change occurred. Then 5 years of doing this volunteer work was more and more rewarding until I decided to become a deputy district attorney in my local county doing domestic violence prosecution.
So now you're prosecuting the people who beat up spouses.
Right.
Tell us about it.
It was extremely rewarding work. Again, it was not about me. It was supporting the victim. Many times women have been abused and they will not come forward. They end up calling the police because they're getting beaten. But the recanting witness is the most common theme in domestic violence prosecution.
Really? In other words, they file a complaint and then they recant.
The victim doesn't file the complaint. We, the prosecutors, do. The victim calls 911.
Okay, but I mean they say when I file a complaint, I mean the victim complains, initiates an action, and then recants.
And says, this black eye was given to me by my husband.
And then recants.
Exactly.
Why?
Because they love that person. They have become under that person's sway and control. Often because that was the life that they had in their home when they were growing up. And they cannot picture being by themselves. They can't picture having the confidence to go out on their own. They don't have the fiscal ability. And it is too much against their interest to actually come forward.
So it's partly emotional. And when you say their fiscal, meaning financial interest, it's partly rational, saying, well, he beat me up, but it would be worse if I were alone, out on my own.
I can't support myself.
All right. So what's your role?
My role was to take the cases as far as I could. Even when the victim would not testify, if I could prove the case without her or him, sometimes it was the male, I would go forward. But the thing I thought I brought to it was the wisdom to let these victims, if they're going to recant, I understand. I would say to them, you will probably be back. It usually takes 5 incidents for the victim to be willing to leave the relationship. I have your file. I'm here for you. When it happens again, we'll just keep trying.
Now, I think I heard you say in that description that the difference in that type of legal work was it was no longer about you, as had been your earlier career.
It's true.
So again, how does that make you feel, looking in the mirror? Put yourself back in that time of handling those cases. At the end of the day, how do you feel?
I still feel really proud of my work.
Anything else? About the difference now between I had a great day versus I helped somebody today.
I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't change the amount of time I spent doing that other work.
And when you say that, because?
It's still important work. You still have to have cases. And it was so fun.
Would I be wrong to hypothesize that that 15-year career in conventional litigation enhanced your confidence and skills to do the work you did in the last 5 years in domestic violence?
I have to say it wasn't so much my 20 years of law practice that made me effective in the DA's office, but my nonprofit work. It was the compassion that was different.
You've been retired now for several years, caring for your terminally ill mother. You've had this highly unorthodox career. What are your thoughts now?
I feel like I didn't do enough. And I wonder if there's some other work that I could go back to. I definitely had to not work to help take care of my mother. But maybe that's true for everyone, that you never really come to a satisfying end.
Kim Clement, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. We'll